Well, we want to welcome you this morning. If this is your first time with us, a special welcome to you. If you're coming back to us after a long time away from church, we're glad you're here. If you're a regular attender, you make this ministry possible. So thank you, thank you, thank you. We are in the second part of a brand new series entitled Brand New. And this is a video that you just saw. Jesus invites us to become a part of a revolution that can change the world. And when Jesus came to earth, he started something that was entirely brand new. We started talking about this on Easter with the death and burial and resurrection of Jesus. A new era was ushered in. As a matter of fact, Jesus put it this way. He said, a new covenant I begin, give you with my blood. And so it's a brand new day, a brand new thing that God is doing, a brand new way for us to understand and a brand new way for us to communicate with the God of heaven. To illustrate this, in John chapter 4, you know the story. Some of you know the story. If you grew up in Sunday school, you know this story well. Jesus has been in Jerusalem, and people were starting to flock to him, and a lot of people were starting to be baptized. He wasn't baptizing them, his disciples were. But when that started to happen, the Pharisees took notice, and they got a little bit concerned because, you know, all of us know that when you have a large group of people, obviously there's some compromise somewhere. At least that's what we tend to think, I think. Jesus was starting to get the attention. Instead of dealing with this, instead of fighting with it, he decides to go back to Galilee. On the way back to Galilee, he doesn't take the route that a normal Jewish boy, particularly a Jewish rabbi, should have taken, you know, kind of walking around and avoiding the area of Samaria. He goes right through the wrong section of town. And as he's going through this section of town, he comes to a well, and he's tired. He sits down at the well. His disciples go into town to see if they can find some lunch. And a woman comes. And Jesus does something that's unthinkable. He strikes a conversation up with her. Now, Jewish men would never talk, particularly to a Samaritan woman. And rabbis, particularly, would not talk to any woman in public. You may or may not know this. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting. They wouldn't even talk to their wives in public. If you were the wife of a rabbi, when you were out in public, if you were going somewhere with him, you had to walk 10 paces behind him. That was the way it was done. There is no way that a good Jewish boy and a good Jewish rabbi, particularly, is ever going to talk to a woman, let alone a Samaritan woman. But Jesus strikes up a conversation with her, starts to talk about giving her living water, and she's very interested. And when he starts to talk about that, she says, you know, I want this. So Jesus says to her, okay, what you need to do is go home and get your husband. And all of a sudden now, he's getting too close for comfort. Do you ever notice when you try to talk to somebody about Jesus, there are those times when all of a sudden the red lights go up. Stop, 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 stop. We don't want to go there. Well, that's what she does. So she tries to change the subject. And what she does is she says to him, ask him, she says, sir, I can see that you're a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place that you worship has got to be in Jerusalem. So who's right? We say here, you say there. Who's to know what's right? And the thing that you need to know is up to this point, every religion in the world operated on what we call a temple model. That's not just Judaism. That is every religion. The people in Egypt operated on that. The people in Hinduism way across in India, where most of them didn't even know about, operated on that. You know, whether you are Phoenician or Egyptian or Jewish or Samaritan, you all operated on the temple model. And the temple model, frankly, is how most religions continue to operate today. What's the temple model? The temple model, very simple. What you have is you have sacred places, some place you go to. We say it's here, you say it's there. We say it's Baptist, you say it's Presbyterian. Whatever it is, we have this sacred place that we go to where Sacred men are going to talk to us about our sacred text. And all of this happened with a group of sincere followers who have gathered together for this teaching. That's what the temple model is. When Jesus came on the scene, he introduces something brand new, entirely new. As a matter of fact, we kind of see it in this passage when he responds to this woman. He says this, he says, "Woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, the time is coming where you will neither worship the Father on this mountain nor in Jerusalem." In other words, he's saying it's not about a place. It is not a sacred place that you have to go to. It is not location. And then he goes on. And he says, "You Samaritans worship what you do not know." Now, come on, that has got to be really offensive to this lady. He has just told her, you know, you're trying to worship God, you don't have a clue about what you're doing. I mean, how would you feel if someone came up to you and you started to talk to them about your spiritual journey, you started to tell them what you believe, and they kind of shook their head and said, "You are so stupid when it comes to what you're trying to do. It doesn't work that way." So this would have been so offensive to this lady, because these people, the Samaritans, they were kind of, you know, part Jew. What happened is when Assyria came in, one of their policies when they took over a land is they forced people into intermarriage. And so as they did that, the Jewish element became kind of corrupted. As a matter of fact, so much so that when the Samaritans got back to the land, they took the Pentateuch and they changed it. There are 6,000 differences between the Samaritan Pentateuch and the Masoretic text. They came in, they changed everything in order to fit what they wanted to do, how they wanted to worship. And you know, the truth of the matter is that many people today, we do try that same thing, don't we? I like this part of that religion, I like this part of that religion, I like this part of that religion. I'm just going to make my own way to God. And I've got to tell you, if you're saying that, Jesus would say to you, you don't have a clue about what you're doing. You don't know. And as offensive as that is, you got to hear it. I've got to hear it. He goes on to say, "We worship what we know, because salvation is from the Jews." When man fell in the garden, and I don't know about you, I happen to believe in 6 days of creation. I've studied it. I was a biology major at the University of Pittsburgh studying pre-medicine. I thought I was going to be a doctor of medicine instead of a doctor of theology. I studied all of this evolution through genetics and through all of that stuff. So if you want to talk about it sometime, I am glad to talk about it, because I love talking about this stuff. Having been there, having studied it, having knowing the facts about what we're talking about, I have come to the conclusion that we are created beings. And I believe that he created in 6 days. And I believe that because I believe Jesus believed that. He believed in Adam and Eve. And in the garden, Adam and Eve rebelled against God. We call that sin. They basically said, "God, you go your way, I'll go mine. I do not need you telling me what to do. I can run my own life. Thank you very much. But when I'm in trouble, I expect you to come running." When that happened, God began a plan of redemption. Part of that plan of redemption, that means buying us back, fixing what we had broken. You know, he didn't have to do that, but he did. And he began it through a guy named Abraham and the people that we recognize as Jewish people. Salvation is of the Jews. The reason he did that was not because Abraham was special. He did it because he was special, and he said, "Look, I want to get my message to you uncorrupted so that you can know who I am." And so through the Jewish nation, what we received is we received the Old Testament scriptures, the written word of God, so that we can know something about God. And then we received in Jesus' day the living word of God, Jesus himself. Salvation is from the Jews. And he goes on and says, yet a time is coming. And I love this next phrase. And has now come. I am introducing something brand new into this fallen world, is what Jesus was saying. And he says, the time has come when true worshipers will worship the Father with the old gospel hymns, in the old tried and true ways, and the sawdust on the trail, and all of the old. No! Those who worship him will worship him in spirit and in truth. For that they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is a spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. And that means that when we really worship God, something changes inside. You know, it is not possible for you to come to a sacred place, sing sacred songs, hear a sacred text from a sacred man, and go out and be the same type of person that you are when you came in. If that's the case, you haven't worshiped at all. He says you worship when something in your spirit touches me and you know the truth. And later on he says, and the truth sets you free. And so Jesus is saying to this woman, he says, now the time has come. Suddenly, God is so much more accessible than he used to be. You don't have to go to a sacred temple, a sacred place with your sacrifice. You don't have to travel miles and miles and miles in order to do this, because it is not location anymore. I am doing something brand new. And what Jesus does is he says, now you are sacred. It is the person, not the place, that is sacred. I want you to take a minute. Just look to your right. Look to your left. Okay, see the person that's beside you. See the person who's in front of you. What Jesus has said is that there is no place on the face of the earth that you can ever go that is more sacred than that person sitting next to you. He did something brand new for each one of us. And he did it for us. And he expects us to react in ways that are brand new. You know, one of the things that I run into sometimes as a pastor is I talk to people and I find out, you know, that we Christians don't always behave the way Christians should behave. And it's kind of sad, you know. I mean, I talk to waitresses who say, you know, I hate to see the Christians come in. First of all, I know they're going to be irritating because the food was too slow, it was too hot, it was too cold, it was too something. And secondly, most of those Christians are cheap. They're not going to tip. I used to go to lunch. I stopped going to lunch with this guy because what he would do is he would come in and when it came time to leave, he would put a track down. That was his tip. Last time I went to lunch with him, and it was really bad because the front of the track looked like a real $100 bill, but the back of it was the plan of salvation, and I'm saying, you know, you can't do that. And he'd, oh, yeah, it's good. So I waited till he left the table, and I'm not kidding you, this is the last time I went to lunch with this guy. He left the table, and I put down the best tip I could put down for this lady. I generally, personal opinion, as a Christian, whether or not they know I'm a Christian, whether or not they know I'm a pastor, I don't care what the service was like, the waitress is going to get a 25% tip. That's just my standard, okay? Because, you know, you don't know what these people go through. And if your food is late, it's not her fault or his fault, okay? It's not. So I'm always trying to be generous. So I put down my tip for this guy. Well, the guy who had gone up to pay for our lunch saw me do it. And as I walked away from the table, I saw him circle back around from the table, grab my tip, pocket it, And that was my reaction too. This is just ridiculous. Folks, here's what you need to know. If you call yourself a Christian, everything that you do and everything that you say is either going to draw someone to the Savior or it's going to drive him away from him. And there are no neutral ground. Don't excuse yourself. Well, that's just the way I am. Then you need to change. You know, when you join Gateway, and we don't push membership real hard here at Gateway, and I never have, and I don't, never will. But when people join Gateway, you know that we have a little ceremony that we go through because we take church membership very seriously. And one of the things that happens is when they stand up in front of you, these people promise that they're going to live a life that is worthy of the name of Christ. That they're not going to live in such a way that's going to cause embarrassment to us out there in the community. They're not going to live in the community a way that's embarrassing because of their behavior. And we take that very seriously because at Gateway, what we're trying to do is we're trying to create a church that unchurch people love to attend. If you're here and you're not normally a church person, you know, and you're a little bit uncomfortable, I want you to relax. We are not trying to get anything from you. We do want something for you. And you don't have to agree with all the stuff that you hear, because I understand that some of it is very difficult to hear. But, if you hang around us long enough, you'll begin to understand some of the things that we believe in, and it'll begin to make some sense to you. So we're trying to build a church that unchurched people love to attend. And you know, what's the alternative? Building a church that people hate to come to? I mean, seriously. Think about that for just a minute. And you need to know something. The church that I grew up in and the church that a lot of you grew up in, it has to change. It has to change. There is nothing wrong with the old ways and the tried and true tradition. But you know and I know that those old ways and those tried and true traditions many times get in the way of people seeing the Christ we're trying to represent. And we dare not continue to hold on to the things that hold us back. Well, that's just the way it is. That's the way we've always done it. And here's what I know. What people resist about the church today, the church should be resisting. When all the Gentiles started to respond to Paul's teaching, it created a problem with the Jewish Christians because the Jewish Christians grew up in the Jewish traditions and they wanted to bring those Jewish traditions into the brand new thing that Jesus was starting. And so they started to say, okay, wait a minute, before these Gentiles can become Christians, they first have got to agree to the Old Testament. They've got to agree to the Old Testament law. They have got to start living like Jewish people. And, this was a big thing because for the guys it meant surgery. So all the women were in the church, listening to what was going on, and the guys were outside saying, I don't think so. So they come to an agreement. James, the brother of Jesus, puts it this way. He says, we need to stop making it difficult for people to come to God. We need to take those things that, yes, they're tried and they're true and we love them and they're our traditions, but we don't need those things to stand in the way of people who were nothing like us and did not grow up like us. We need to make it possible for them to come to Christ, and we don't need to make it unnecessarily difficult. You know, when unchurched people see the church, here's what they see. This is how unchurched people define the church. They say the church is a community of people. Now, the church all of the time doesn't get that one right. At least they do. The church is a community of people. It is not a building. It is not a place. It is not a location. It is the community of Christ followers who happen to come together for worship and for edification and for strength. So it's a community of people following the teachings of a man. That one is partially right, because we believe that the main part that we follow with Christ is we follow the Christ what he did, who he was, and that's our main focus. Jesus did not come to preach the gospel. Jesus came so that there would be a gospel to be preached. And without Jesus and the cross and the resurrection, there is no Christian message. There is no teaching that we follow. But because of the gospel, because of the cross, and because of the resurrection, because of the man, there is a teaching that we have to follow, and so we understand that. They believe that he's a man sent from God, and we agree with that too, and we believe more than that. We believe that he's not only a man sent from God, we believe that he was God himself. God come looking for us. To explain God, in other words, to tell us what God is like, it's much better than that. We Christians believe that he came not to explain God, he came to demonstrate God. You want to know what the Father is like? Just look at Jesus. That's what he said. When Philip said, you know, hey, we want you to show us the Father, he said, wait a minute. I've been with you so long time, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. So here's what I believe, and here's what we know. If you move away from Jesus, you move away from God. Period. It's the only way. And to clear the path to God. And that's what we believe he did. By his teaching. Now, here's the thing. If that's the case, there's nothing in that that really people should dislike except maybe the fact that we believe that Jesus is God. But there's nothing that people should resist. There's nothing they should like. As a matter of fact, the three top teachings of Jesus are love God, second, love one another. And this one's a little tough, but it's one of the top teachings. Third, love your enemies. Love those who don't love you. As a matter of fact, one of the times Jesus was teaching his followers, he said, it doesn't do you any good to love those who like you. Even godless people do that. He said, but you're to love those who despise you and who are your enemies and who, you know, use you wrongly. You're to love that person who is tough. And I got to tell you, there is nothing resistible to this. Unless you're saying, that's just too tough. That last one. No. Nothing resistible. And for the first 300 years of the church, the people of God followed this. They didn't have influence. They didn't have meeting places. Many times they were meeting in secret, in hiding, because they were persecuted. And they were persecuted not because they were judgmental. They were persecuted not because they were exclusive. They were persecuted not because they were selfish. They were the most loving people, the most giving people that you want to see. When plague hit the Roman Empire, everybody fled except Christians. Even the priest of all of the Roman gods, they left the city because they didn't want to get sick. They were all afraid. We're going to die if we hang around. Christians stayed there because they weren't afraid of death. And many of them died caring for the families of people who had been abandoned by their families. And that got Rome's attention. And this first group of Christians weren't persecuted because they were judgmental or mean-spirited or selfish or anything like that. They were persecuted because the Jewish people said, you believe Jesus is Messiah, and we don't like that. I mean, we're the ones who stood there and say, crucify him, crucify him. Let his blood be on us and our children. And you're saying he's God and we crucified our Messiah. No, we don't like that. So they persecuted the early Christians. Rome persecuted the early Christians because they refused to bow to Caesar as God. They had one king, and that was Jesus. And they wouldn't follow the Roman gods. As a matter of fact, did you know that in the first century, second century, and third century, Christians were considered atheist because they wouldn't worship the Roman gods? Classical atheism does not mean that you don't believe in a god. It simply means you don't accept the god that's the god of that nation. And because Christians didn't do that, they persecuted these Christians. And they resisted them and persecuted them because of their loyalty to the man, Jesus of Nazareth. And they said, we can't go with that. He was crucified. He was buried. And by the way, that's something just for the footnote in history. Most people who were crucified were never buried. You weren't allowed to be buried if you were crucified. Roman law said you hung on the cross until your body rotted away, and then somebody got up and scraped off what was left, and then they took it to the town dump. The reason they took the guys early was because of the high holy days. The other two guys were thrown in the town dump. That's what should have happened to Jesus, but Joseph of Arimathea intervened, and Pilate agreed, and so he was buried. And on the third day, he rose again, and these guys didn't say, we heard it. This is a story we're telling. They said, we saw it. We know it. And that sounded so strange when Paul gives this message on Mars Hill. There are people who just, you know, they ridiculed him for that. But they stuck to their guns. And so the people resisted them because they taught that Jesus was God in the flesh. Jesus was the only way to God. And I got to tell you, if people resist us today, that should be why. Nothing else. That should be why. If people take offense at our message, it should be the offense of the cross and the resurrection and our commitment to Jesus Christ as Lord. In the second century, the emperor Hadrian, who was the 14th emperor of Rome, was the emperor from 117 AD to 138 BC. He hated Christians, just like the emperors before him. And he was looking for ways to persecute them. So he got this guy by the name of Aristides, and he said to Aristides, I want you to go and I want you to join yourself with the Christians. You are going to be my official spy in the sect of Christians, and you're going to tell me where I can go, where I can get them, where I can kill them. And I want you to give me a report of what they're like. And so Aristides wrote these reports as a spy inside, a spy back to Hadrian, and they were mixed messages sometimes, because one of the things that he said that Christians did is he said in their communion, they eat their children. They're cannibals. They should be killed for that because they're so cruel. And of course, you know, it's because of the body and blood of Christ that we sang about. So that's what he wrote. And he wrote all of these things about them, but there's one phrase that he wrote that has come down to us all the way from the second century. Because not only did he say it, but other people started to repeat it too. Here's what he wrote. All of the stuff. Here was the most memorable thing that he wrote. Behold how they love one another. And he couldn't get over that. And it was that love. You know, when you were arrested in Rome and put into prison, if your family didn't feed you, you died because they were responsible for your care and upkeep. The state didn't do it. And if you were a young man and they were conscripting you into the army of Rome until they could get you to basic training, guess where they put you? In prison. So you wouldn't try to go AWOL before you got into the army. And here's an interesting footnote in history. At one such time, when persecution was so bad against the Christians, and they were conscripting new young men to go into the army to persecute them more, Christians would go to the jail and they would feed these prisoners who eventually would persecute them and kill them. They would take food to them. They would take clothes to them. They would share with them. And one young man wanted to know, who are these people? And he became a bishop in the early church because of the love of these early Christians. We haven't always fulfilled that, have we? Back in the 70s, some of you were not even born then, but back in the 70s, some of you will remember this, it became popular to be a born-again Christian. the Jesus movement, which had begun in the mid to late 60s, was in full bloom about 1974, 1975, 1976, you know. And then there was a new guy that was going on to the political scene by the name of Jimmy Carter, who claimed to be a born-again Christian. And all of a sudden, because Jimmy Carter was claiming to be a born-again Christian, it became popular to be a born-again Christian. Kind of like in the 4th century when Constantine said, I'm a Christian, and all of a sudden it became popular to be a Christian in Rome. Well, that's what was happening here. Well, the news magazine got the story, and they started to look into, you know, Christianity. They started to study the church, and they ran a cover story in which they quoted a 19th century theologian by the name of William Jones, who also had been studying the church and looking at the church. And his observation of the church was, behold, how they hate one another. How they can't get along. How they fight. How they shoot their own wounded. How they're always at each other's throats. I got to ask you, isn't that the way many people see the church today? I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful if people said about us, you know, Christians make the best neighbors. I mean, they are so helpful. We love living next door to them. Christians make the best bosses. They're honest. They're hardworking. They're kind. They're fair with us. Christians, man, do you see their marriages? I hope my son or daughter marries one of them because they really know how to treat each other. Do you see how these Christian men treat Christian women? Wow. What love and respect. I hope my daughter marries one. I really like what I see. But the one thing I just can't stand is I can't believe their claim that Jesus was God and that he died for me and that I'm a sinner and need somebody to die in my place. I just can't do it. That's why I'm not one of them. Wouldn't it be great if that was the only thing that people had to reject the church? Wouldn't it be great if the only reason people could resist us was because they took offense at the message of Christ that we have, the love? And I got to tell you, I've been in ministry a long time. I have been in ministry part-time. I began ministry in 1968. And then full-time in 1975. So I've been in ministry a long time. I have heard hundreds of reasons why people don't like Christ and why people don't like the church. Very seldom has it ever been it's because of what we believe. More than likely, it's because of how we behaved, what they have seen in us. You know, I talked a little bit earlier about waitresses and, you know, how they, and I've seen it in, you know, in restaurants too. I was talking to a man a number of years ago who owns his own restaurant, and it happens to be near a very popular Baptist church in the area. And I was talking to this man, and you know what he said to me? He said, I love, and I'm not kidding you. I'm not patting ourselves on the back. I'm just going to tell you what he said. He said, I love when Gateway people come in. He said, you know, the people from Gateway, you know, you have never asked for anything that's unreasonable. He said, but this other church, he said, I finally went to the pastor and I said, tell your people they are no longer welcomed in my establishment. And he said, because after the Sunday service, he said, they would come in and they would be mean-spirited. And he said, I couldn't get anybody to work Sunday afternoon because of this group of people who claimed to be Christian. And he said, they'd come in, they would abuse my staff, and then they would tip poorly if they tipped at all. You know, I've heard people say, you know, that I would give you a tip, but I'm going to give this to the Lord. Stop it. Ridiculous. So, got to ask you, how do people view us? How do they view? Do they say, behold how they hate people? Look at them. always angry, always arguing, always looking for something to disagree with? Or do they say, behold how they love? Jesus calls us to be salt and light in the world, not vim and vinegar. Salt and light. And this is so important. And with the arrival of Jesus, the end of the temple model came about and the beginning of something brand new started. Not just for the Jews, but for the entire world. Entirely new. Not Temple 201. This isn't a new and improved version of church. Not Temple 201. You know, I have an iPhone, and they always tell me, you know, you've got to upgrade to the newest iOS model. You know, you get those of you who have that. So I go to my iPhone, and I try to upgrade, and it says, your phone is too old. Need to buy a new phone. It's not that. It's not an upgrade to an old thing. Jesus started something entirely new. And it's not a combination of what Jesus started and temple model. That has seeped back in. We need to let that go. It's not a new sacred place. It is a sacred movement, a people of God. It is no longer, here's where you worship, but worship that comes from God comes from within. And it affects every fiber of our lives. And in case you don't get it, it affects how we deal with other people. This is so important that Jesus, he's talking to his followers one day. They're in the temple, and he's talking about the sacrifice, and these are good Jewish boys. You know, they got it all down. And he says this, this is how I want you to conduct yourself in this manner. If you enter the place of worship and are about to make an offering and suddenly remember that someone has a grudge against you, abandon your offering. Leave immediately. Go to this friend and make that right. Then and only then come back and work things out with God. You see, the temple model is always vertical. You know, as long as I'm doing it right with God, I can be mean as a snake to you. But I'm right with God. I ask God to forgive me for that bad behavior I had. I didn't go to you and ask you to forgive me. God's already taken care of it, so you know, you're just going to have to understand it. This new thing that Jesus introduces is not only is the vertical important, the horizontal is important as well. He said you can't be right with God unless you are right with people. And Jesus takes all 601 plus laws of the Old Testament and he boils them down to just two. One, love God. Two, love people. That's it. That's it. Love God, love people. Can you imagine what would happen in your home if you did these two things? Can you imagine what would happen in our neighborhoods if we lived this way, loving God and loving people? Can you imagine the change that would be in our communities if we did this? The change that would come in our world. You wouldn't have the racial riots that we're having, not riots, but the racial tension that we're seeing today. And it's terrible. I hate to turn on the news and see some of these things, atrocities that are happening. And the reason for it is because, you know, we've kind of abandoned what we're called to do, to be the salt and light, to love as Jesus loved, to love God, to love people. Could you imagine what would happen in our community if we stopped living with the temple model and stopped allowing that to seep back into our worship and started living like sacred people in this fallen world? Started to be brand new people the way God meant us to? If we allowed the image of Christ to be formed in us, to live and to love as Jesus loved? to be his sacred people, demonstrating his selfless love to those, listen to me, to those who don't deserve it. You say, oh, you know, I'm not going to go that far. Jesus said, what good does it do if you love those who love you? Even godless people know how to do that. You're to love those who despise you and despitefully use you and treat you mean. You're to love the mean girl or the mean boy. That's don't like that. I can't do that. I know you can't. That's why you need Jesus. I can't. That's why I need Jesus. His image in me. We're to love difficult people. We're to love people that you don't even like very much. I have people come to me all the time and they say, well, you know, I love so-and-so, I just don't like them. I'm sorry, you don't love them then. Just saying. Here's what you need to remember. Every person is made in the image of God. Every person is going to spend eternity somewhere. It's either going to be heaven or it's going to be hell. Jesus taught about both. And as much as we don't like to talk about it, it's a reality. And here's the scary thing. It's my behavior that may end up determining where they spend their eternity. To help us on this, look at this verse. This is a great verse from Micah 6:8. He says this, he has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. You can't say it any simpler. He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? Not suggest. What does he require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. I want you to try this with me, okay? Here we go. He has shown you, O man. Come on. Repeat with me. He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. What would happen if we started to live like that? How would this world change? How would our neighborhoods change? How would our homes change? How would our community change? How would our nation change? If we just did this one verse, act justly, love mercy, walk humbly with God. And to help you with that, as you're leaving, every one of you are going to receive, it's not anything big, but we're going to give you, make sure you get it, a little memory card with this verse on it. And here's what I want you to do. It's called a memory card, so guess what I want you to do with it? I want you to memorize it. Some of you are saying, I can't memorize. Quick, what's your home address? You know that, don't you? Because you memorized it. What's your phone number? You know that because you memorized it. What's your cell phone number? Well, you looked that one up. Okay, the way to memorize is you take a verse, and I suggest that you do the address, then the verse, then the address. The address would be Micah 6:8 because you want to be able to know where to find it. Micah 6:8, he has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God. And I want you to take, and while you're memorizing that, I want you to take this, I want you to put it in some conspicuous place in your house where you can see it every day. And someday, sometime during the day, it can be in the morning, it can be in the evening when you're done with your day, I want you to ask yourself and honestly answer, how did I do today? How did I do today? Did I act justly to people? Did I love mercy? Did I extend the mercy to people that I expect people to expend to me? You know, one of the problems that we have in the church is so often we want to have mercy for ourselves and judgment for everybody else. Did I extend mercy to people? And did I walk humbly with God? And as you do that this week, sometime during the week, perhaps early next week, just take a few minutes, and I'd like you to write and tell me how it went. What changes maybe it started to make in your life? How you're doing with it? You know, Pastor, I blew it. And by the way, when you blow it, and you will blow it, because you're sinful. So am I. That's why I need Jesus. When you blow it, make it right really quick. Go and ask for forgiveness. And move on. And I want you to write and let me know, how did it work? How did it change? How did it challenge you? Maybe some of you will write and say, you know, that didn't work so well for me. I had to be nice to this guy who I wanted to smack upside the head. He showed you, O man, what is good. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. Let me pray for us. Father, thank you so much for extending mercy to me when I didn't deserve it. And I still don't deserve it, and I'll never deserve it. But you, in mercy and grace, loved me when I was unlovable. Matter of fact, the Apostle Paul put it this way, while we were still your enemies, Christ died for us. And he set for us an example to follow. And Lord, forgive me for those times when I don't follow that example very well. And I pray that for all of us who know Christ and haven't maybe even followed the way we should. Give us the strength this week to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with you, cooperating with you in all things instead of trying to manipulate you to do what we want. And we'll be careful to give you the praise for it. In Jesus' name, amen.